This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Dahlia Lithwick joins me live in studio. She is a columnist with Newsweek magazine and a contributing editor at Slate magazine online at slate.com. It's good to see you. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Yes, indeed. We were talking about our mutual friend John Whitehead and his appearance on The View tomorrow. It's going to be fun to watch how he does with those women.
I can't wait. I bet he's going to show them a thing or two.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
So speaking of showing people a thing or two, it has been certainly the goal of Virginia Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli to show people a thing or two by being aggressively out front in his opposition to the new federal health care legislation, which opponents call Obamacare. And everyone is saying, well, you know, this will all be decided in the Supreme Court. You were just telling me, don't hold your breath.
Well, I think I'm of two minds about it, Coy. I mean, there was a time when I thought, just to review, there have now been four federal courts have weighed in on the constitutionality, specifically of the individual mandate piece of the Affordable Health Care Act. Two, not surprisingly, Republican appointees have struck it down. Two, not surprisingly, Democratic presidents' appointees have not surprisingly upheld it. So far we've seen an absolutely partisan split in the courts in terms of whether the thing is constitutional. So really the question you're asking is, where else can this get resolved but at the U.S. Supreme Court? And I think the betting has largely been that it's going to end up at the court. I happened to be at a conference this weekend where an awful lot of people were saying, not going to go to the courts. The court doesn't want to touch this.
A bunch of legal scholars.
But I think the very strong feeling that by the time these cases work their way up to the courts of appeals, so we've got a case out of Virginia, Henry Hudson, who struck it down. We've got the case out of Florida, and that was filed not only on behalf of Florida, but 35 other states' attorneys general filed in that suit that not only struck down the individual mandate, but actually struck down the entire statute, saying the entire thing is unconstitutional, that by the time the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals and the 4th Circuit Court of Appeals are done with it, they're both going to uphold the statute. There's going to be nothing for the court to do. So the court really doesn't want to get involved in this. And unless there's a split between the circuits, unless we continue to see an outrageous split where half the courts say it's good, half the courts say it's bad, and all the courts of appeals are split, the court's going to want to keep their hands out of this mess.
Yeah. Ken Cuccinelli, of course, is making an effort to fast track this directly to the Supreme Court and bypass any intermediary courts.
Right. He filed a request to have an expedited hearing to sort of skip the Fourth Circuit altogether and go straight to the Supreme Court. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg made comments last week. I think they couldn't have been more forcefully directed at Ken Cuccinelli if she had said, and listen, Ken Cuccinelli. She didn't. But what she said is the court almost never accepts these requests to fast-track cases because it's in the court's interest to have the appeals courts weigh in, to have other judges weigh in. In this particular case, the court's going to want to have many, many other courts refine the issues, define the issues, so that by the time it gets to the Supreme Court, it's very crisp and clear. The record is crisp. We know exactly what we're fighting about. And so what Justice Ginsburg said was, we very, very, very rarely do this, and in a case like this, it's really pretty unlikely that we're going to do it. Although I think it goes to the fact that Cuccinelli is in a foot race with the other lawsuits. He filed his motion to strike down the suit. You'll recall he wanted to do it before the ink was dry on the president's signature, and he did. He ran it over to the courthouse. So part of what you're seeing is a little foot race between a whole bunch of, I think, pretty kind of political attorneys general across the country who want their suit to be the one that goes to the big show.
So there's definitely an effort to use this to get some ink, to get some media attention.
Yeah, and I think that being the guy who brought down Obamacare would be a feather in anyone's cap if one had political aspirations. And so certainly a little bit of what you're seeing, I think, at least on the parts of the states attorneys general is an effort to be the guy whose suit became the vehicle for, you know, the ultimate kind of knockdown when it happens at the high court.
It's 5:15. We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick of Slate and Newsweek. The phone lines are open at 977-1070. So the legal scholars that you have talked with around the country have said this is very unlikely to actually go to the Supreme Court. They don't want to touch this. But aren't they just looking at the legalities and the law and forgetting the fact that some of these guys on the Supreme Court are very politically astute and conscious and, nay, motivated, perhaps?
Well, one of the things that I have found so interesting, really fascinating, is that when these suits were filed, not only did constitutional scholars say the court isn't going to want to touch this, but everyone went on the record saying even if the court does take it, it's going to be 8-1, 7-2. Everyone agreed the court's going to uphold this thing. There is no constitutional issue. The court's been upholding this kind of congressional legislation since 1937. These were very, very interesting and pressing constitutional questions in the 1930s until the FDR court said, you know what, we're going to let Congress do. We're going to have them, you know, really broadly defined powers under the Commerce Clause. Now, here we are. 7-8 months later, and an awful lot of people are saying, well, maybe it's going to be 5-4 at the court. Maybe it's going to be 6-3. Maybe it's going to be 4-4 with Justice Kennedy in the middle. So what I think is interesting, and I think this is at the heart of your question, is that people who were thinking about this in purely constitutional terms 7 or 8 months ago are now thinking in terms of, you know, maybe the court doesn't want to make a purely constitutional decision. Maybe there is ideology. Maybe there is politics at work here. And certainly, I think if you think about the Roberts Court as a court that has done a lot to unroll sort of the Warren Court legacy in the last couple of years, it's not out of the realm of possibilities that you could get 3 or 4 or possibly even 5 votes to say, maybe this hasn't been an open question since the 1930s. Maybe it's time to reopen it.
Dahlia Lithwick is with us. She's a columnist with Newsweek magazine and a contributing editor to Slate magazine online at slate.com. Let me ask you about the article that was in the New York Times about Clarence Thomas and their observations that he hasn't had that much to say.
Is
that putting it nicely?
It's an understatement. We're coming up on the 5-year anniversary since of the last time Clarence Thomas spoke at oral argument. In other words, he has sat through 5 years of oral arguments without saying a word. That's a record breaker.
Is he asleep?
No. He's often giggling with Justice Breyer. Often his head is sort of tilted up and he's looking at the ceiling. Often he's rifling through papers. I'm not a psychologist, Coy, but I think he's kind of trying to give a fairly clear social signal that he doesn't want to be there.
And again, it's no secret in Washington that he hates Washington.
That he doesn't want to be there either. Yeah, no, I think this is of a piece with a lot of the things he said about he doesn't much care for this job. One of the things that's interesting in the New York Times piece, which is a really thoughtful piece about whether it matters that he hasn't spoken in 5 years. But one of the things that's interesting is that he's told different groups of people at different times different rationales for his choice not to speak. So sometimes he tells audiences, he grew up with this very, very strong Georgia dialect and nobody understood him and he's embarrassed about it and that's why he doesn't speak. He's also said oral argument is an embarrassment because the judges are talking so much that the advocates can't get a word in edgewise and he just doesn't want to participate in that. And then at other times he said, I just don't find it helpful for judges to ask questions. So he has a sort of array of things that he uses to justify his decision. But I think there is a general sense that if this is the court's only public face, if this is the only – we don't get to watch them in conference. We don't get to see them at any other time. Not accidentally, Thomas is one of the people who boycotts the State of the Union speech. So if you don't get to see the justices doing their jobs at any other time, is there some obligation to participate in the one thing that is the public face of the court? And Thomas's answer is no.
We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick. And of course, as you know, I've actually interviewed him before, have been on the phone with him for more than an hour. He can be a very personable, friendly, very engaging conversationalist. He's a nice guy when you talk to him.
One of the great paradoxes at the Supreme Court is if you ask any law clerk who is the most outgoing, gregarious, warm, generous justice on the court. It's Thomas. He knows every clerk's name. He takes them out to lunches. He knows the cleaning staff by name. I mean, this is not an act. He's got this great booming laugh that just reverberates through the room. So there's no question that he is incredibly gregarious and warm-hearted. It's just that he's created a public persona that is completely different from his private persona. And, you know, I would sort of recommend to readers to read his autobiography, My Grandfather's Son, because he really explains why he's been so badly burnt by the confirmation hearings and why he feels the way he feels about the public. But the dichotomy between the person, the Clarence Thomas, that if you get to know him at all, you can respond to very warmly, and the person he is on the bench, or, you know, his wife's activities, the very, very partisan rhetoric that comes out of that family. It's hard to reconcile the two.
Yeah. We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick of Slate and Newsweek. Any interesting cases coming down the pike for the next few months in the court?
Kind of. The big one, I think, that everybody's watching. I mean, we're watching to see decisions in a couple of cases that were argued in the fall. And so everybody's waiting to see, for instance, if the court's going to uphold the violent video games ban in California, whether they can regulate the sale of very, very violent video games to minors. So there's some that comes up as a free speech case. Incredibly interesting. The other one that people are waiting with bated breath is the Fred Phelps family, the funeral protest case. So whether protesting at a private military funeral and drawing a lot of attention to your, in this case, anti-homosexual views is protected political speech. So again, a First Amendment case. A lot of excitement about those. The cases that the court has yet to hear that we're very, very interested in are the big, big Walmart class action suits. So we've got, you know, thousands of Walmart employees trying to create a class to sue Walmart.
That's been going on for years, hasn't it?
It has. It's finally come to the court. Walmart's answer seems to be just, we can't afford this. So we'll see how that shakes out. A very, very interesting national security case about the material witness statute that's coming up. And very, very soon, I think the court's going to announce whether they're going to hear another big, big Ten Commandments case. We haven't heard a Ten Commandments in a public space case in quite some time. So the court is trying to make a decision about whether it's finally ready to hear another one.
Interesting.
You know, these are always very fun cases.
How do you think the First Amendment thing with those protesters at the funerals, how do you think that the Roberts Court will fall on that?
You know, it was an interesting argument. The case was argued on behalf of the Phelps family. Now, this is the Westboro Baptist Church. It's a tiny little church that goes out of its way to offend everyone.
Yeah.
And it was argued by Fred Phelps' daughter, Margie Phelps. And that may have been a bad decision, only insofar as I have never seen anyone anger the justices as much as she did. In other words, it was her case to lose. I think the law is clearly on the side of the Westboro Church. I think the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals got it right when it said, even though this is abhorrent, awful speech, it is protected speech. We have sort of neutral time, place, and manner regulations about where they have to stand.
And a private funeral is not like a crowded theater yelling fire?
No.
When there is no fire?
There's no fire. I mean, this is one of the questions in the case is whether this is, you know, the rule should be different for private individuals, whether this is the Hustler Falwell category of cases, you know, public figures, different standards. But I think that it seems that this is clearly protected speech, even though we hate it. But there was such a strong sense that this, even though we hate this speech and it's protected, these people are so fundamentally awful that you could sort of see justice by justice peel off and try to find some way to say, let's create a teeny beeny little class of speech just for Fred Phelps because he's awful. I think that they will still prevail at the Supreme Court, the Phelps family, but I think that Margie Phelps did not help herself by arguing that case.
We're talking with Dahlia Lithwick. Before we let you go, just your thoughts on recent efforts in the Congress on the part of Republicans to redefine abortion such that it would only be violent acts and that redefine rape so that it would only be violent and that rapes that didn't involve violence wouldn't actually be classified as rape.
Well, this is all part of, you know, promises that were made in the new Congress to limit women's access to abortion. And it's of a piece with other efforts to defund Title X, to defund Planned Parenthood, to suggest that Planned Parenthood is just a criminal enterprise. There were a bunch of gotcha videos that were released earlier this month that seemed to suggest that everything that happens at Planned Parenthood is about enabling sex trafficking. So I think it's just a type of rhetoric that suggests that not just are we opposed to abortion, but we're opposed to family planning, we're opposed to contraception, we're opposed to anything that happens at Planned Parenthood clinics is just going to be defunded. And so part of that was an effort to say that rape provisions that have abortion provisions that have always paid for rape in certain classes of cases, the health of the mother, incest, rape, are going to be narrowed down. And so, you know, one of the ways to do that is to change the language around rape from rape to, quote, forcible rape. The idea being that I guess some rape is consensual rape or ambiguous rape. Right. That language has fallen out of this particular law. But I think that people who are worried about the availability of contraception, of mammograms, HIV testing, the kinds of things that have happened at Planned Parenthood that have nothing to do with abortion whatsoever. If one is worried about that, one wants to be very, very worried about some of the bills that are coming down the pike that would severely limit not just women's access to abortion in emergency situations, but women's access to basic health care, particularly poor women's access.
So the fact that this effort to redefine rape, that language may be out of the law, but there's still a whole lot of language remaining, either whether it's in that bill or other bills, that are the continued efforts on the part of conservatives to defund Planned Parenthood, even though it may have nothing to do with abortion.
That's right.
Specifically for stuff that has nothing to do with abortion.
Right. It would eviscerate the entirety of Planned Parenthood's budget, and also legislation pending, you know, really alarming legislation that would allow doctors and hospitals to invoke a, quote, right of conscience to not even treat a woman who's in a situation where if she does not get an abortion, she will die. The idea being that she can bleed out if the hospital feels like it is not within their realm of conscience to treat her. So that kind of legislation, I want to be very, very clear. You know, the Hyde Amendment is already on the books. We have an enormous amount of legislation on the books that prevent taxpayers from funding abortion. This isn't taxpayer-funded abortion. This is chipping away at the definition of what is a medically necessary abortion, what is a constitutionally protected abortion, and what is basic women's health care, I would say preventive health care, chipping away at those things in legislation that I think is very, very, very frightening to anybody who thinks about providing health care, basic preventive health care, particularly to poor women.
Dahlia Lithwick is a columnist with Newsweek and a contributing editor to Slate magazine online at slate.com. Dahlia, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SevillePodcast.com for more.